Chapter 19. Lion Rampant. They discovered the foundry sector entirely deserted upon their return. The Dark Angels found many of the perimeter outposts still intact, shielded from the blast wave of the bombardment by virtue of being sheltered in the lee of thick-walled manufactories. But the soldiers who manned them were gone. Johnson sent First Company and Brother Titus ahead with orders to secure the assembly building, while Second Company moved along at a slower pace. They'd recovered three rhinos from outside the warehouses and loaded them with the most seriously injured battle brothers, while the rest of the company followed along behind the vehicles with the bodies of the fallen. Nemiel and Cole, reunited with the rest of their squad, found the body of Brother Marthys on the way back and made him a part of the somber procession as well. As they made their way into the foundry precincts, they began to hear the faint rumble of thrusters off to the south. Now and again, Nemiel and the others would look back in the direction of the far-off starport and search for telltale streaks of light that would signify the descent of an orbital transport. The Dark Angels knew that with every passing minute, the wolves were gathering at their backs. It would only be a matter of time before they began to close in. Force Commander Lamnos, who was also the commanding officer of First Company, was waiting outside the assembly building when Primarch Johnson and Second Company arrived. "The building has been secured, my lord," he reported. "We encountered several squads of stragglers inside, but they weren't in much shape to put up a fight."
"What about the siege guns?"
the Primarch asked. "All present and accounted for. The building weathered the blast very well, and the vehicle sustained no damage." Johnson nodded.
"Well done, Force Commander. Let's get the wounded inside, then begin developing a defence strategy."
He cast a wary eye to the south.
"I believe we've only got 2 or 3 hours at most before the Sons of Horus begin their attack."
The Astartes went to work immediately, scouting out the terrain and scavenging working heavy weapons from the abandoned enemy emplacements. Johnson and the company commanders assembled outside the assembly building, along with Nemiel and Brother Sergeant Cole, to review the terrain and develop a proper defensive perimeter. The Primarch favoured a layered defence, with an outer defensive ring encompassing the entire sector and an inner ring centred solely on the assembly building. The First Company was put to work on the outer ring, while the Second Company was assigned to the inner ring.
"At this point, we only have enough strength to successfully defend about half of the outer ring," Johnson said.
In the absence of a hololith table, one of the Astartes had scratched a crude map of the foundry sector into the permacrete with the point of his power knife, and the Dark Angels had gathered in a circle around it.
"Naturally, we'll orientate our defence to the south, because the rebels will use the most direct approach, at least initially,"
the Primarch continued.
"We'll sight our captured las cannons and heavy stubbers on rooftops here, here, and here."
He indicated a series of buildings on the outer edge of the sector that provided commanding fields of fire down the main avenues of approach.
"The las cannon gunner's priority is to knock out as many vehicles as possible and strip the attackers of their support. Most of First and Second Companies will be arrayed in a wide arc covering all the southern routes into the sector. Three squads will be kept in reserve and mounted in our rhinos to provide swift reinforcement to weak parts of the line."
He paused, studying the map thoughtfully.
"As the battle wears on, we can expect that they will probe around our flanks, looking for less well-defended areas. We'll have to stay flexible and be ready to reorientate our squads at a moment's notice, falling back to the inner line, if necessary."
"What about Magos Archoi and the remaining Skitari?"
Force Commander Lamnos asked. Since taking the assembly building, there had been a few brief skirmishes with Skitari units from the north. Johnson shrugged.
"Archoi himself is most likely dead," he replied. "I expect he fled right back to his stronghold and was caught in the bombardment. Just in case, however, I want to post a squad of wounded battle brothers onto the roof of the assembly building to act as observers. If they detect a serious threat from the north, we'll dispatch our mobile reserve to deal with it."
Lamnos and Captain Hsien of Second Company nodded in agreement. Neither warrior looked particularly pleased with the tactical situation, but Johnson had devised a plan that made the best use of the assets they had available. Still, Nemiel couldn't help but note a grim undercurrent in the manner of the two leaders. They carried themselves like warriors who were about to make a final stand, and had already resigned themselves to their deaths.
We've got almost 150 Battle Brothers able to fight, plus a dreadnought,
Nemiel pointed out.
We should be able to hold the foundry almost indefinitely with so large a force. The Emperor knows we managed to hold off a horde of orcs with far less than that back on Barrakhan.
If we were only facing Skitarian conventional troops, I would agree with you, Lamnos said readily. But this time we're dealing with the Sons of Horus. This may well prove to be the toughest battle that any of us have ever fought.
There's also the matter of supplies, Hacien pointed out. Our warriors were fully resupplied before the attack began, but we'll go through our basic stocks of ammunition within a few days of heavy fighting, he said.
Johnson raised a hand.
All of these things are true, he said, but we also have a number of advantages here. First, we have something that the enemy desperately wants, so they cannot bring their heaviest weapons to bear on us without risking a direct hit on the siege guns. They can't just sit back and blast us with artillery. Instead, they've got to come in and dig us out, which makes their job much more difficult. Secondly, their fleet is much smaller this time than it was during their first attack. Horus put together a raiding group with whatever he had immediately to hand, so I expect they have supply issues of their own. If we can defeat their ground units and drive them off the planet, the fleet will have little choice but to withdraw. And I doubt that the War Master will risk a third attempt with the Emperor's punitive force drawing nearer.
He gave the two company commanders a steadfast look.
This won't be a protracted siege. Far from it. The enemy will have enough resources to sustain only a few days of intense combat before they will have to retreat. That was another factor in my decision to bombard the forge. Within a week, they'll be more desperate for resources than we will.
The Primarch's assertions effectively ended the discussion. Everyone knew of Johnson's strategic brilliance, and the mood of the company commanders was buoyed by his self-assurance. But Nemuel, ever the cynic, couldn't help but note the things that the Primarch left unsaid. The attacking force was small, but fresh, and though their resources were finite, they were undoubtedly well-equipped. And it didn't matter if the Dark Angels could hold out a month or more if the Sons of Horus managed to overrun them in the very first battle. The company commanders left to join their respective commands and complete preparations for the coming fight. Nemiel and his squad went to join the Mobile Reserve. Johnson had specifically ordered the Redemptor to join the reserve force.
You'll be most needed where the fighting is hardest, he told Nemiel. I can't have you getting bogged down guarding some access road while the enemy is breaking through on the other side of the perimeter.
Nemiel accepted the order with a brusque nod.
Where will you be, my lord? He asked.
A faint grin crossed Johnson's handsome face.
Why, I'll try to be everywhere at once, the Primarch replied.
Hours passed, and the tension began to mount. The sounds of orbital transports descending through the overcast grew more frequent as the day progressed. At mid-morning, they heard a faint crackle of small arms fire off in the far distance, somewhere out in the grey zone, and the Astartes wondered if some of the dragoons had somehow managed to survive. The sounds of combat tapered off within a few minutes, however, and an uneasy quiet descended once more. 4 hours past dawn, they heard the rumble of engines off to the north, and the observers on the top of the assembly building reported a small force of APCs were heading for the northern perimeter at high speed. Nemiel and the reserve forces, accompanied by Johnson himself, hurriedly climbed aboard their rhinos and raced down the access roads to meet the oncoming threat. No sooner had the Astartes deployed into cover around the perimeter's ruined buildings than 4 Testudo personnel carriers burst into view. Battered-looking dragoons clung to the top decks of the APCs, and all of the vehicles showed signs of recent battle damage. Johnson and Nemiel stepped from cover and waved at the vehicles, which quickly changed course and slid to a halt some 10 meters from the two warriors. The dragoons on the tops of the vehicles regarded them with glassy-eyed expressions. The Testudos lowered their assault ramps, and more troops spilled out into the daylight. Among them was Governor Kulik, still wearing his carapace armor and limping along with the help of a cane. Johnson stepped forward, raising his hand in salute.
It's good to see you, Governor, he said.
After Magos Archoy's betrayal, we'd feared the worst. For the first few hours, so did I, Kulik answered. Archoy took us completely by surprise, damn him.
He turned and indicated his battered force with a sweep of his cane.
This is all I have left,
barely half a company out of a starting strength of 20,000 men. He turned back to the Primarch, and Nemiel could see the pain etched across Kulik's face.
We knew that if anyone could survive Magos Archoy's treachery, it would be you. So we loaded up the only vehicles we had left and managed to slip through the northern gate in the hopes of finding you.
What's the situation beyond the curtain wall?
Johnson asked. Kulik's face fell.
The Skitari control the fortifications in the Grey Zone, and probably the southern gateway as well. We couldn't get close enough to find out, he said. A small convoy of Tech Guard headed out to the starport at first light. Since dawn, we estimate that 8 to 10 heavy troop transports and a number of dropships have landed there.
He nodded his head to the south.
The last we saw, their vanguard units were on the move, heading north. The damned traitors are going to lead them through the Grey Zone and probably past the southern gateway as well. They'll be here within the hour, I expect.
Johnson stepped forward and laid a hand on Kulik's shoulder.
You and your men have fought courageously, Governor, he said. They've given everything they have in defense of their world. Let us take up the banner from here. You can withdraw back to the north and slip into the countryside, while we hold off the rebels.
Kulik stiffened, and for a moment Nemiel feared that he would take insult at Johnson's heartfelt offer.
My men and I are honored by your offer, Kulik said after a moment. But we're going to see this through to the end, if it's all the same to you.
Johnson nodded somberly.
Welcome, then, he replied. Have your men take positions here, covering our northern approach. We've had some skirmishes with Skitari patrols, and we're worried that Archoy may be planning an attack.
I damn well hope he tries, the governor said,
a fierce look crossing his face.
If he does, we'll deal with him, Primarch Johnson. You mark my words.
With that, he turned on his heel and began snapping orders to his men, and the dragoons went to work with surprising speed. The reserve force returned to their start position, and the wait began once more. Nemiel stepped outside the rhino and sat down against its armored flank, trying to balance his humors and rest his body with meditation. 10 minutes later, the observers called across the command net and said that a large force of armored vehicles was approaching from the south. Orders were passed along the company command nets, and the Dark Angels readied their weapons. 20 minutes later, they felt the rumble of the armored columns reverberating through the earth, drawing closer with every passing moment. Plumes of black petrochem exhaust rose from the midst of the warehouses to the south. Then, the gunners atop the buildings facing the enemy advance began to call out sightings. 3 columns of heavy tanks and APCs approaching fast. To Nemiel, it sounded like an entire mechanized battalion heading straight down their throats. Johnson received the news calmly.
Las cannon emplacements. Target the main battle tanks and open fire at 450 meters, he said.
The range was already so close that the anti-tank lasers opened fire almost at once. Bright red beams shot down the narrow roadways and struck the lead tanks head-on. One of the vehicles exploded with the first hit. Another lost one of its treads and ground to a halt. The third tank pressed forward with a gouge scored along the side of its turret. Its battle cannon elevated and fired a high-explosive shell with a hollow boom. The round overshot, flying past the weapons emplacement and crashing into a manufactorum on the north side of the sector. The Astartes kept firing, sending beam after beam at the tanks, until finally all 3 were knocked out. Behind the wrecks, the remaining tanks and APCs were forced to retreat and spread out further along the side lanes before resuming their advance. The rebel forces came on in a much broader formation this time, their vehicles arrayed in a wide crescent that nearly encompassed the entire southern perimeter. This time, the heavy Stubbers joined in the battle, raking the enemy APCs with bursts of armor-piercing shells. The enemy responded with battle cannon shells and autocannon bursts, and the air was filled with explosions and blossoms of fire. The Astartes placed their shots with brutal efficiency, aiming for the known vulnerabilities in the armor plating of the battle tanks and destroying 6 in the space of just a few minutes. The APCs fared no better under the hail of shells from the heavy Stubbers as the armor-piercing rounds found weak spots in their hulls and punched their way inside, wreaking bloody havoc on the troops embarked within. Several shuddered to a halt, and exploded as tracer rounds touched off their fuel cells, until finally the battalion commander ordered the rest of the infantry to dismount and continue the attack on foot. The infantry squads exited their transports and charged across the 15-meter open space, only to be cut down by heavy stubbers and disciplined bursts of bolt gun fire from concealed Astartes squads. 20 minutes after the attack began, the rebel advance faltered and began to withdraw. They left behind 20 knocked-out vehicles and more than 200 dead soldiers. 3 of the Dark Angels' weapons emplacements had been destroyed by battle cannon fire, and 3 Astartes had been slain. The First Legion could claim victory in the opening engagement, but the battle was only beginning. The Sons of Horus had yet to make an appearance. Over the course of the next 3 hours, the Dark Angels repulsed 5 more attacks. Each time, the rebels refined their tactics and probed more aggressively around the Astartes' flanks. Each time, they drove back the rebels with significant losses, but casualties among the defenders mounted, and with each attack, they lost one or more of their few remaining las cannons or heavy stubbers. To Nemiel, it felt as though a noose was slowly being tightened around them. The rebels dropped mortar rounds onto the outskirts of the sector during the third attack, targeting buildings where they knew a heavy weapons emplacement was located. By the 6th attack, the enemy APCs were growing bolder, advancing within 10 meters of the sector perimeter before being turned back. An hour passed before the commencement of the 7th attack, allowing the Astartes time to redistribute ammunition and tend their wounded. The Dark Angel spirits had been restored by the time the first mortar rounds began to fall, and when the rebel tanks and APCs began their advance, they opened fire with their few remaining heavy weapons and prepared for close-quarters combat. This time, the rebel tanks and APCs closed in on the perimeter from 3 sides, and the weight of fire from the defenders wasn't strong enough to stem the tide. The enemy vehicles hit the first defensive line in a score of places. They poured cannon and heavy stubber fire into the manufactories as they pressed deeper, forcing the Astartes to break cover and assault the lumbering vehicles. Within minutes, both companies were involved in dozens of squad-level melees as the Dark Angels came to grips with platoons of heavily armed infantry. And then, judging that the decisive moment had come, the Sons of Horus launched their attack.
"Rhinos approaching from the north!"
Nemiel heard the call over the vox and saw the enemy strategy at once. While the rebel infantry had been probing the extent of the Imperial defences, the Sons of Horus had been moving under cover of the attacks in a sweeping movement to the north that would bring them around behind the Dark Angels' positions. It was the kind of swift, decisive strategy that made the Sons of Horus such deadly opponents on the field of battle and reflected the tactical prowess of their illustrious Primarch. Now, Nemiel and the Mobile Reserve was all that stood in their way.
"Move out!"
he ordered as he leapt inside the lead rhino and slammed the troop door shut. The 3 transports roared into motion, circling around the assembly building and racing down the access ways to the northern perimeter. He switched to the command net and called the rooftop lookouts.
"How many rhinos are we facing?"
he asked.
"I count 4,
one of the lookouts replied.
"The dragoons are engaging them, now!"
The Tanagran troops stood their ground in the face of the enemy charge, and the autocannons of their 4 testudos began to spit bursts of armor-piercing rounds at the oncoming transports. 2 of the lightly armored APCs were hit and ground to a halt, smoke pouring from their wrecked power plants. A 3rd caught fire and exploded, scattering burning debris in a wide arc. Had the vehicles been crewed by human troops, the attack would have been stopped cold, but the hatches on all 3 of the destroyed vehicles slammed open, and squads of pale-armored warriors fought their way free of the wreckage and resumed their attack. They were fearsome apparitions of war, their battle-scarred armor clad with 2 centuries' worth of campaign honors and prize trophies looted from worlds stretching the length and breadth of the Imperium. Once, they had been called the Lunar Wolves and had been the first of the Astartes legions to be reunited with their Primarch. Their name had been synonymous with the Emperor's Great Crusade for nearly 200 years. Now they were called the Sons of Horus, and they had drowned Istvan III in the blood of 12 billion innocent souls. Bolt guns blazed, wreaking carnage among the dragoons. Plasma guns spat bolts of charged particles that bored into the front armor of the testudos and blew 2 of them apart. The lone surviving rhino continued forwards, firing bursts from its remote-controlled twin bolter until it crashed into the enemy positions and dropped its rear assault ramp. Another squad of rebel Astartes charged out of the vehicle and attacked the surviving dragoons in close combat, carving through the exhausted soldiers with snarling chainswords and glowing power weapons. The Tanagran troops were on the verge of collapse when Nemiel and the reserves arrived. He ordered the APCs to halt 15 meters back from the melee so that the three squads could deploy in good order. The Redemptor looked across the battlefield at the fearsome, pale-armored warriors. There were four full squads against his three understrength ones. He and his men were in for a rough fight. Igniting his Crozius, Nemiel led the charge.
"Loyalty and honor!" he cried. "For the Lion and the Emperor!"
Brother Sergeant Cole took up the war cry, and in moments all 23 of the Dark Angels were shouting too as they crashed into the ranks of their foes. Nemiel saw a rebel warrior cut down two screaming dragoons and then turn upon him. He rushed at the son of Horus, channeling all of his rage into a sweeping blow from his Crozius. But the veteran warrior sidestepped the blow with fearsome speed and slashed the Redemptor across the wrist. Had it been a power blade, the sword would have sliced off Nemiel's hand. As it was, the teeth of the chainsword raked across his armored gauntlet, scoring deep gouges in the ceramite plates. The Redemptor lashed at the rebel with a backhanded stroke, feinting for the warrior's head, and then striking downwards at his knee. Again, the Astartes nimbly dodged the blow, and then brought up his bolt pistol and shot Nemiel in the head. The blow to his helmet blinded Nemiel and knocked him off his feet. He registered the impact across his shoulders as he struck the ground and felt blood trickling down the bridge of his nose. The bolt pistol round had failed to penetrate his helmet, but the impact had split it and damaged the delicate circuitry beneath the ceramite plates. His vision came back in flashes of red-tinged static, just as the edge of his enemy's chain blade pressed against his breastplate. He felt the whirring teeth skip and screech across the curved plate, scrabbling for purchase. In another few seconds, he knew that it would mar the surface enough to bite deep, and then he was as good as dead. With a shout, Nemiel brought up his pistol and fired a shot into the side of his opponent's knee. The bolt round punched through the relatively weak joint armor and blew the warrior's lower leg off. The Astartes collapsed with a roar of pain and rage, and Nemiel threw himself atop his foe, batting aside his chain blade with the barrel of his pistol and slamming his Crozius down on the warrior's helmet. The helm imploded with a bright blue flash, and the son of Horus went limp. Gasping, Nemiel tore at his damaged helm one-handed until he finally pulled it free. A pitched battle was raging all around him. The dragoons were nowhere to be seen, leaving his warriors to fight the numerically superior sons of Horus alone. Pistols flashed and thundered, and blades drew sparks as they slashed across the curved surfaces of power armor. He saw a Dark Angel take a shot from a plasma pistol at close range and fall to the ground. Then another lose his arm to a deadly lightning claw. A rebel Astartes toppled, run through by Brother Sergeant Cole's power sword. Brother Ephrael smashed a rebel to the ground with the butt of his melter gun and blew the prone warrior apart with a searing blast of microwaves. The heat generated by the blast staggered everyone around him, all except the pale-armored warrior who had slipped behind Ephrael. Brandishing a huge power fist, the son of Horus punched Ephrael in the back of his head, killing him instantly. Nemiel leapt to his feet and charged at the warrior who'd killed Ephrael. A plasma bolt shot past his head, close enough to sear the skin on the side of his face, but he scarcely felt the pain. He raised his Crozius, and the rebel seemed to sense the blow at the last moment. The warrior spun about, bringing his power fist up in a ponderous arc that nevertheless managed to deflect Nemiel's attack. The rebel spun on his heel and, quick as a viper, brought up a plasma pistol and loosed a bolt at Nemiel. But the Redemptor anticipated the move just in time and dodged to the side. The shot missed his shoulder by centimeters, flashing past and striking someone behind him. He heard an agonized scream, but had no time to see whether friend or foe had been hit. He lunged forward before the traitor could fire another shot and smashed the pistol's barrel with a jab from his Crozius. The Astartes hurled the ruined weapon at Nemiel's face, following behind the feint with a sweeping blow aimed at the Redemptor's abdomen. Nemiel dodged to the right, narrowly avoiding both attacks, and brought his Crozius down on his enemy's left shoulder. The warrior's pauldron shattered beneath the impact and broke the traitor's shoulder along with it. The son of Horus was driven to his knees, Before he could rise again, the Redemptor crushed his skull with another blow from his power weapon. Nemiel whirled about, taking stock of the battle even as his last foe toppled to the ground. Every way he turned, he saw pale-armored figures pressing in on his warriors from all sides. Bodies of friend and foe alike littered the ground, but he could see at once that his warriors had suffered the worst in the exchange. There were less than a dozen left, including Brother Sergeant Cole and Brother Cortis. The Dark Angels were instinctively drawing together into a tight knot, standing back to back in a classic defensive formation that had its roots on Caliban. They were outnumbered more than 2-1, but they refused to yield a centimeter to their foes. For the first time in his life, Nemiel truly felt that he was about to die. A strange peace settled over him at the thought, and as he joined his brothers, he prepared to give his life for the Emperor. Then suddenly, a shout went up from the Sons of Horus, and the entire mass of enemy warriors recoiled away from the Dark Angels. Stunned, Nemiel whirled about, searching for the source of the enemy's retreat. Lion L. Johnson fell upon the rebels with a fierce cry, the lion sword blazing as he carved through the enemy ranks. The rebels fell like wheat before a scythe, cut down before they scarcely had a chance to move, much less strike at their foe. Johnson was a vengeful god, a whirlwind of death and destruction, and the Sons of Horus retreated before his wrath. The enemy fell back to their rhinos, firing their pistols to cover their withdrawal. The Dark Angels traded shots with them until the enemy had disappeared inside their transports and the rhinos turned and sped out of range. Only then did Nemiel turn and take stock of their losses. With dawning horror, he saw that only 8 warriors besides him were still standing. 15 of his brothers lay dead upon the Permacrete, surrounded by the bodies of a dozen of their foes. They had turned aside the enemy attack, but the reserve force had been decimated. If the Sons of Horus launched another attack, there would be little left to stop them. The Dark Angels had taken a terrible toll on the enemy, but they had paid an equally terrible price in return. The Sons of Horus had slain many of their battle brothers, but even worse was the horror of spilling the blood of fellow Astartes, something utterly unthinkable just a few scant months before. Out beyond the perimeter, they could hear the rumble of engines and sense that the enemy was reforming for yet another attack. Johnson took stock of his remaining forces and reluctantly ordered his remaining warriors back to the inner defensive line. Nemiel was summoned by the Primarch as he and his squad were helping carry the most gravely wounded brothers into the assembly building. There were only 60 warriors still standing. Force Commander Lamnos lay in a coma, his primary heart and his oolitic kidney ruptured by an autocannon blast, and Captain Hussein had been killed when his position had been struck by a battle cannon shell. The Tanagran Dragoons had died to a man fighting the Sons of Horus. Nemiel had found the body of Governor Kulik surrounded by his troops, his sword gripped in his hand.
"I have a task for you, Brother Redemptor Nemiel," the Primarch said.
Beside him, Brother Titus stood sentinel beside the assembly building's open doors. A plasma bolt had fused the barrels of his assault cannon, but his deadly power fist still functioned.
"What are your orders, my lord?"
Nemiel replied calmly.
"It's absolutely vital that the siege guns do not fall into Horus's hands," Johnson replied. "Do you agree?"
Nemiel nodded.
"Of course, my lord."
"Then we must take steps to ensure that they are destroyed in the event that the Sons of Horus break through," the Primarch said. "I want you to find Tekmarin Ascalon and instruct him to prepare a demolition device that will destroy the assembly building and everything within it. According to him, the siege gun's ammunition sections are fully loaded. If he can rig the shells to detonate, it should devastate everything within a 5-kilometer radius."
The Redemptor nodded somberly. The order wasn't unexpected. Once he'd heard a full tally of their losses, he knew that their odds of victory were growing slimmer by the moment.
"I'll see to it at once," he said.
He left the Primarch and hurried into the assembly building. On the way, he caught sight of Brother Sergeant Cole and the rest of the squad taking their place with the rest of their brothers at the inner line. For a moment, he and the sergeant locked eyes, and Cole seemed to understand what the grim look on the Redemptor's face signified. Nemiel gave the veteran a knowing nod, and the sergeant saluted him in return. There were close to 100 seriously wounded Astartes laid up inside the assembly building, their conditions monitored by the ground forces apothecaries. Nemiel searched among the unconscious or comatose figures, looking for Ascalon, and frowning worriedly when he could not find him. "Up here!" echoed a familiar voice. Nemiel looked up to find the Tech Marine standing atop the dorsal hull of the lead siege gun. Ascalon pointed to the rear of the huge vehicle. "There are ladder rungs back at the ammo section." Nemiel hurried back to the rear section of the war machine and scrambled up onto the dorsal hull. The armored deck stretched for 100 meters from one end to the other, nearly as long as an Imperator Titan was tall. He jogged down the length of the huge machine, joining Ascalon by the open hatch where they'd watched Archoy's technicians work just a few hours before.
"What in Terra's name are you doing up here?" Nemiel asked. "Brother Apothecary Gideon said you should be resting. Your internal organs and nervous system were badly damaged when you tapped those power conduits."
Ascalon waved such concerns away.
"I'm not doing us any good sitting down there on the permacrete," he said hoarsely.
Burn sealant had been spread across his burned face, giving the charred skin a synthetic sheen.
"So I thought I'd climb up here and see if I can get this monster running."
Nemiel's eyes widened.
"Is that possible?"
Ascalon sighed.
"Well, in theory, yes. The engine is functional, the weapon's fully loaded, and the void shields, all four of them, check out as ready for activation. The problem is that there aren't any manual controls."
The Redemptor frowned.
"That doesn't make any sense. Even a Titan has a crew to assist its princeps."
Ascalon nodded.
"And these vehicles were built with supplementary crew stations, but our choice tech adepts took out all the controls and welded the hatches shut."
The Tech Marine shook his head.
"It doesn't make any sense. I can't imagine what Horus thought he could use to operate these machines. The systems aren't quite as complex as a Titan, but they're close."
He spread his arms and gave a frustrated sigh.
"So, here we are with the firepower of an army in our hands, and no way to use it."
The Redemptor scowled down at the open cockpit. A thought niggled at him.
"Is there any way to rig a basic set of controls to the machine, even just to operate one of its void shields?"
Ascalon shook his head.
"Actually, operating the void shield is one of the most complex operations to manage. Just ask any Titan moderati. Rigging an effective set of controls would take hours, possibly days."
He shook his head.
"Unless you have a spare MIU sitting around, there's nothing we can do."
Nemiel glanced up at the Tech Marine, his eyes widening. Ascalon frowned.
"What's the matter?"
he asked.
"We do have an MIU, Nemiel said. "It's been right under our noses all along."
The enemy launched their 8th and final attack an hour and a half later. Lionel Johnson listened to the approaching sounds of engines and readied his sword.
"Here they come," he said to Nemiel.
Around them, the surviving Astartes checked their weapons. At the Redemptor's urging, they had extended the perimeter of the inner line outwards another 250 meters, stretching their coverage almost to breaking point.
"Ascalon is working as quickly as he can, my lord," he said to the Primarch. "We have to buy as much time for him as we can."
"This is a terrible risk we're taking,"
Johnson replied. Amid the mounting tension, the Primarch managed a faint smile.
"If we fail to hold them back, and somehow we aren't both shot to pieces in the process, I'm going to hold you personally responsible for this."
Nemiel nodded.
"Duly noted, my lord,"
he said in a deadpan voice that would have made Brother Sergeant Cole proud. The enemy vehicles advanced from three sides, nosing their way through the maze of close-set buildings and closing in on the assembly building. By careful planning, or sheer diabolical luck, most of the enemy vehicles emerged from cover at the same time. Nemiel counted 10 Rhino APCs and, directly ahead, a patched-up battle tank. A square metal plate had been bolted over the crater blasted in its glacis by a las cannon bolt, and the Rebels' technicians had jury-rigged enough of its wrecked controls to get it back into action. The tank shuddered to a halt as the rest of the APCs surged forward. Its turret tracked fractionally to the left, and the battle cannon fired. The heavy shell howled through the air towards the Dark Angels and struck Brother Titus's armored torso. The dreadnought vanished in a thunderous blast, hurling bits of its arms and chest high into the air. Shrapnel rained down on the defenders, the metal fragments pinging off their armor. Johnson straightened in the wake of the blast, his expression tense. 20 meters away, the rhinos came to an abrupt halt. Assault ramps dropped to the ground as 10 squads of pale-armored Astartes disembarked and took shelter behind the cover of their vehicles. Farther back, the tank traversed its turret to the left, taking aim on a Dark Angel squad.
"This won't work," the Primarch snarled. "That tank will sit back there and shoot us to pieces, and then the Sons of Horus will sweep in and mop up the survivors."
He drew the lion sword and held it aloft. Sunlight shone on its razor edge.
"Forward, brothers," he cried, "for honor and glory, for Terra, for the Emperor. Forward!"
All 60 Dark Angels rose to their feet in a single fluid motion and advanced towards the Sons of Horus, a thin line of black against a waiting phalanx of white. The battle cannon boomed again, but the gunner failed to adjust for the sudden enemy advance, and the shell blasted a gout of dirt and permacrete into the air behind the Astartes. The rebel warriors rose from cover and opened fire as well. Plasma bolts and shells stabbed out at the advancing Imperials, and the Dark Angels returned fire. The two formations drew inexorably together. Nemiel clutched his Crozius tightly and prepared for one final battle. A tremor rippled through the ground beneath their feet, very faint at first, but growing in strength with each passing moment. Nemiel felt it through the soles of his boots and turned to Johnson, who had felt it too. A throaty roar filled the air behind them, swelling outwards in a solid wall of sound, as one of Horus's mighty siege machines rumbled slowly onto the battlefield. The war machine rose like a plasteel and ceramite mountain over the Astartes, its hydroflak batteries and megabolter turrets along its flanks traversing to bear on the enemy ranks. The multi-barreled laser batteries opened fire, unleashing a torrent of bolts at the stationary battle tank. The tank all but vanished in the glare of hundreds of detonations as the laser bolts pounded the armored hull. Individually, each shot lacked the power to penetrate the mighty tank's reinforced ceramite plates, but one among the hundreds of impacts landed a direct hit on the plate steel bolted hastily over its former wound and burned straight through. Smoke billowed from the tank's open ports as the thermal effects of the bolt incinerated the crew in a split second. A pair of mega-bolters roared to life next, sending a stream of heavy-caliber shells over the heads of the Dark Angels and into the enemy's ranks. Rhinos shuddered beneath dozens of hits and were torn apart in seconds. The Astartes standing alongside them fared little better. The Sons of Horus recoiled under the storm of shells. Dozens of the warriors fell, their armor riddled with holes. The rest wavered for a moment more and then broke, retreating swiftly back into cover among the surrounding buildings. Megabolter shells pursued them the entire way, slaying a dozen more before the rest could escape. The Dark Angel stood in the shadow of the immense war machine, wreathed by wisps of physoline propellant from the barrels of the megabolters and numbed by the awesome roar of the guns. Alone among them, Lionel Johnson turned to the enormous engine and raised his sword in salute.
"Well done, Brother Titus," he called over the vox. "You could not have arrived at a more opportune time. Tech Marine Ascalon deserves your accolades, my lord, not I," replied Titus's synthetic voice. "It was no small feat merging my MIU with the war engine's interface without access to the original STC blueprints. Only the specialized tools and equipment in the assembly building allowed him to modify the vehicle's interface with my neural connectors. I regret that I am still unable to access the vehicle's shield array, and my locomotion is still very slow and clumsy, but all weapon systems are fully functional."
Johnson stared up at the mountain of metal.
"Brother Titus, can your surveyors detect the starport to the south?" "The unit is in need of calibration. But yes, I am registering it on my array," Titus replied. "I am detecting 12 heavy transports and numerous small vehicles."
The Primarch nodded.
"Load a shell into your siege gun and destroy the site."
Titus hesitated for only an instant.
At once, my lord, he replied.
With a ponderous moan of heavy-duty motors, the giant cannon barrel began to elevate.
Loading will complete in 5 seconds, Titus said. I advise that you take cover behind me. I cannot adequately gauge the effect the gun's concussion will have when it is fired.
As Primarch and War Machine spoke, Nemiel cast his gaze upon the devastation that Titus had wrought. Scores of Astartes lay dead, surrounding misshapen metal hulks that were functioning APCs just a few minutes before. Behind him, heavy plasteel machinery rattled and groaned as the siege gun's auto-loading mechanism fed a magma shell into the cannon's breech. Recalling what such shells had done to the forge, he felt a deep sense of dread. What horrors could a warlord wreak with such weapons at his command? The Astartes withdrew 100 meters behind the huge machine, nearly to the entrance of the assembly building itself. Nemiel glanced over at Johnson and saw the Primarch staring off to the southwest, towards the unsuspecting starport. The air blazed with a flare of orange and yellow light as the cannon fired, rocking the massive war machine back against its drive units. Nemiel felt the concussion of the blast like the fist of a god striking his chest. Several of the Astartes staggered beneath the blow, while downrange the pressure wave hurled the wrecked rhinos about like broken toys. The magma shell roared skyward, flaring like a shooting star until it was lost from sight behind the planet's thick overcast. They waited in silence, counting the seconds as the shell reached its apogee and began to fall to earth once more. 2 minutes after the shot, there was a flash of searing white light on the southern horizon, followed by a furious rumble that shook the earth where the Astartes stood more than 30 kilometers away. A hot breeze wafted against their faces, smelling of molten steel and ash, and a slowly rising pillar of dirt and debris climbed portentously into the sky. With a single stroke, the enemy ground force had been utterly destroyed.
Such is the fate of all traitors, Lionel Johnson said.
The implacable look in the Primarch's eye made Nemiel's blood run cold.